From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll learn about the new Center for Research in Psychoactive Substances at UW-Madison. Then a new report shows fewer students are filling out a key financial aid form. We'll find out what that could mean for college enrollment.
So when we talk about these completion rates being down, what it means functionally is that fewer students have access to financial aid when they're considering being able to go on to college and university.
We'll look at five things to do this month in Milwaukee, plus learn about the career and legacy of South Milwaukee native and pro wrestler DeCrusher.
He would come out to polka music. He would call himself the man that made Milwaukee famous. You know, back in Milwaukee, he won the crown of Mr. Saloon 10 years in a row, and that's because he could eat the most polar sausage and drink the most beer.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. We'll start with this. There's growing evidence that psychoactive and psychedelic compounds can treat substance abuse and psychiatric disorders. UW-Madison has been researching this field for about 7 years. Now they've officially launched a new center to coordinate this ongoing research and education. The UW Transdisciplinary Center for Research in Psychoactive Substances will explore how things like MDMA and psilocybin affect the brain and behavior. Paul Hudson is the founding director of the center, and he joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to share more.
This area of psychoactives and psychedelic substances is actually about 20 years old in the news space. There was research underway in the late 60s, early 70s, before it was shut down. But led by Johns Hopkins and Roland Griffiths and his team at Johns Hopkins, there has been a resurgence in interest in the area of psychedelics. And they have, among others, developed some really fantastically interesting and encouraging results with the use of psychedelics for depression and for various substance use disorders. We have various strengths here at the University of Wisconsin-Madison that we think we will bring to this space, but we also have, in a sense, defined what the usual dose is going to be for psilocybin, for example, based on our early research. So I think we've got a substantial amount of credibility in this space, even though we're a few years behind Hopkins and New York University in entering this clinical research space.
So let's break down some of the nitty-gritty here for listeners. Can you explain the difference between psychedelic and psychoactive effects? And then what are some of the agents and substances you are going to be looking deeper into in these studies?
Yes. There was a lot of enthusiasm about calling this a psychedelic center. We felt, though, that there was an issue of optics, for one, that perhaps it might be inflammatory to be calling it psychedelic when, in fact, some people might consider that to be a red flag, if you will, to raise more attention and for the wrong reasons. But actually, there's a really strong justification for calling this center or focusing on psychoactive substances, because there's some suggestion that the therapeutic effect of these drugs, if there is a therapeutic effect that we define in more complex and more mature studies that are underway, that this effect may not require a psychedelic experience. It may be that there is a fundamental effect of these drugs in the brain, and that the psychedelic experience is just the icing on the cake, if you will. And there's also an understanding that many of the drugs that we're looking at, such as MDMA, ecstasy, Molly, are some of the street names, are not really psychedelic drugs. And yet the MAPS group in California is showing with their phase 3 studies that are being supported by the FDA as a breakthrough drug, they're showing that MDMA, not a psychedelic drug, is having a very psychoactive effect. It seems to be having a dramatic effect on the remission rate of PTSD when combined with psychotherapy. And so actually we're creating a larger tent by calling this a Center for Psychoactive Substance Research, as opposed to focusing on psychedelic research.
But I suppose maybe the average person might not know that, right? Psychoactive versus psychedelic. So do you think public perception versus academic perception is the public one, the bigger hurdle to get over?
Well, I think that there's a lot of misunderstanding about psychedelics. For one, when I first got into the space about 7 years ago, I thought that psychedelics were addictive. And that was certainly the impression given by my early education many, many years ago. But there's really no evidence that psilocybin or LSD are addictive substances in the way that we typically define addiction. And so I think that there are some benefits in calling it psychoactive, but it does cloudy the water a little bit, and it does require a few minutes of explanation about why we're not calling it psychedelic. Having said that, I think that there are also those individuals who are concerned about, and rightfully so, about the potential dangers of using psychedelics in an environment that's not, in a sense, protected while the person is having the psychedelic experience. And that's one of the things that I think that we're trying to provide with the center is a clarity of why we're doing this work and how we're doing this work in a structured, safe, somewhat complex fashion to try to improve the safety of the whole process. The individuals that we are treating, for example, with psilocybin, undergo a 1 to 2 hour psychiatric exam just to make sure that they don't have any underlying mental illnesses that would preclude them taking this medication. They get about 6 to 8 hours of preparatory counseling, and they go through their family history, some of their goals for the session. We talk about how they're going to be able to communicate if they feel like they're somewhat dissociated from their body. Then they have an 8 hour session with two guides that are trained to be able to protect their space, to reassure them. And in the case of MDMA, they are actually providing a protocolized psychotherapy program. And then there's an integration session after that. So this is not anything like a recreational dose of a psychedelic. These individuals are prepared over the course of 6 to 10 hours before the dose. They're attended during the dose by two people. And then they are brought back the next day to sort of interpret or debrief about their session. And I want to also emphasize that these drugs are still, although they seem to have some dramatic effects for depression, for substance use disorders, are not going to work for everybody. And I don't want to make it sound like this is some sort of a panacea.
Well, and this is ongoing research. There's a number of studies underway at this facility as well as across the country. And outside of the psychedelic research and studies active on UW's campus since 2014, I'm curious where this field has been overall in the U.S. You mentioned, you know, it was halted in the 70s because historically LSD was studied in the 50s and 60s, but then, you know, kind of an abrupt end with illegalization and the stigma following kind of the hippie counterculture of the 60s, right? So how does that impact you in the academic field to have such a long period of something getting abruptly stopped and now starting to climb out of that stigma of the late 70s into 2021 here? Are you able to go and look back on what was already established, or do you have to do research and double checking the findings that were left off before the legalization of these drugs?
We've been able to use some of that history of psilocybin and LSD, but not much. The studies were not done in the sort of fashion that we would expect for good clinical research procedures nowadays, but it did give us some indication of how we might prepare the patients, the subjects, and what we might be studying. One of the advantages also of that history is that we've been able to move forward with psilocybin a little bit faster than we might otherwise have been able to do so, just because there is that history of the psilocybin and the traditional use of psilocybin in Native American ceremonies. The work that was started at Johns Hopkins actually started there because some of the people that were involved in this research in the late 60s and 70s were still there. And they had this expertise, this knowledge about how to bring it into the modern sense of what a clinical study should be. And so it was a natural that they should start with that. The work that it's being done there with depression has been very impressive. And this work is being developed in partnership with the FDA, because the FDA has declared the psilocybin as a breakthrough drug in the same fashion that it has declared MDMA for PTSD a breakthrough drug status. What that means is that the FDA is supporting and helping the developers of these two compounds bring it to a new drug application. It has not been a problem getting approvals for the use of MDMA or psilocybin in these studies, for me at least, at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And in fact, informal conversations with people at the FDA have said to me that they're really excited about this research and that they are hoping that it is going to prove to be as useful as we think it may be. Just don't get cocky. Don't cut any corners. Just do it right.
How does taking these substances along with a therapeutic session work in our brain exactly to potentially treat things like depression and addiction?
We don't really know how these psychedelics and entactogens like MDMA work. We have an understanding of what kind of receptors in the brain they're binding to. But after that, we really don't know what happens. Is it just a pure pharmacologic effect, or is it an effect upon consciousness that somehow needs to be experienced and integrated? We don't know. We have a very interesting study going on here in Madison that is taking normal volunteers and giving them both a dose of psilocybin, but also doses of midazolam, which is a drug that many people will recognize from their colonoscopies. It's a drug that makes you forget the procedure. It's basically going to remove your memory of that experience. And the question we're asking is, can we safely administer this combination and then take it to patients with depression? Our question is, if we remove this memory of your psychedelic experience, do you still have a therapeutic effect? And we feel that this is going to be a really important study, and we are very excited about it. And we have to thank the Shannons for their donation to support this research. It's been a huge, it's a study that is widely anticipated in terms of the results.
So usually research in the use of psychedelics and psychoactive agents involves white adults, and I assume mostly male, but the role and impact of psychedelic compounds spans across many different cultures, and as you mentioned, including indigenous communities. So how is the center planning to better reflect this in its work going forward?
One of the things that has been noticed by the investigators themselves at other institutions is that the studies that have been done that have been so encouraging for depression and substance use disorders have not had a appropriate representation of minorities, Black, American Indians, Asian, Hispanic. The lack of this diversity is raising the question about what kind of response we can expect from these treatments in these individuals, but also if we need to modify how we approach the dosing of these patients with different art, with different music, and different invitations. What are the concerns that these different racial and ethnic groups have about participating in this research? And how can we assure them that this is above board and is not trying to be an abusive process? There are a lot of reasons why American Indians, for example, and Black Americans might be suspicious about medical research. And we need to find out what those concerns are and how we can present this research in a fashion that reassures them that they will be protected. There are other components of this research, though, that just make it difficult to do. And this requires multiple trips, and transportation can be a barrier. The time away from work can be a barrier. The time away from children, if you're a single parent, can be a barrier. And so we're anticipating that we're going to need to make some adjustments in terms of how we not only present the research, but how we can make it easier for them to participate. So how are we going to be able to leverage our understanding of how to do this safely to make it available to more people? And we're still grappling with that. Other people are grappling with that as well.
Paul Hudson is a professor in the School of Pharmacy at UW-Madison and the founding director of the new UW Transdisciplinary Center for Research in Psychoactive Substances. He spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski. The pandemic has taken a toll on high school graduates' post-secondary plans. In 2019, 58% of Wisconsin high school grads enrolled in college. In 2020, that number dropped to 48%. A new report from the Wisconsin Policy Forum looks at a key indicator for college enrollment, FAFSA completion. The FAFSA is a federal financial aid form that gives students access to Pell Grants, scholarships, and loans. The number of Wisconsin students filling out the FAFSA has been declining since 2019, and the losses were even bigger at high schools serving mostly students of color. WUWM education reporter Emily Files spoke with Wisconsin Policy Forum senior researcher Sarah Shaw about why FAFSA completion numbers matter and what they're telling us.
The FAFSA numbers and why we track completions and completion rates are important for a couple of reasons. The first is that FAFSA is many students' first step into the world of financial aid. So FAFSA is what gets students eligibility or access to federal dollars, work-study loans, but also is used by many other entities to determine aid and scholarship eligibility. So when we talk about these completion rates being down, what it means functionally is that fewer students have access to financial aid when they're considering being able to go on to college and university. So that's kind of the most practical immediate implication. The larger implication beyond that is that students without access to financial aid are far less likely to be going on to college and university. And so from students' perspective of whether or not they have that opportunity, from higher education institutions' perspective of are they going to have students enrolling, and from the workforce perspective of will they have prospective workers in the future who have the qualifications necessary for the job openings, to see a decline in FAFSA is a really concerning signal of what may be coming in post-secondary enrollment and completion.
So what was happening with the number of Wisconsin high schoolers filling out the FAFSA prior to the pandemic? What trends were happening and for different groups of high schoolers?
Yeah, so we were unfortunately expecting to see a pretty significant decline during the pandemic. And it was interesting to look at what was happening just before that. So there was a good jump from 2016 to 2017 in the percentage of 12th graders who filled out the FAFSA. We went from under 50% in 2016 to over 54% in 2017. But it did start to tail off after that. So 2018 going down to 53.5%, 2019 going down to 52.7%. So that indicates that this COVID slide is not something that was solely due to COVID, that there were factors in play causing the completion rate to decline even before the pandemic hit. Now, what was interesting and encouraging is that for our students who might benefit most from the FAFSA, their completion rates were continuing to increase all the way through 2019. So I'm thinking specifically of our students who are attending schools that serve a majority of students of color, and students that attend schools that serve over 10% English learners in their enrollment. The flip side of their continuing to grow in FAFSA completions through 2019 is that it's all the more discouraging to see that progress lost once the pandemic hits when we look at the 2020 and 2021 numbers.
Right. So students of color were making progress in FAFSA completion, or at least high schools that serve majority students of color were tracking upwards in the few years before the pandemic. Then the pandemic happened. And what happened to those high school graduates of 2020 and 2021?
Yeah, we see the gains erased. So looking at students who attended schools serving majority students of color, the FAFSA completion rate in 2019 had gotten up as high as 52, almost 53%. And by 2021, it's down to 39.5%, which is lower than where we started tracking the data in 2016. So not only erasing progress made, but actually falling below, not the starting point overall, but based on where we had started tracking the data.
So when you talk to school and district officials about the decline in FAFSA completion during the pandemic, what were some of the reasons they gave for why that happened?
Yeah, in some ways, we were hoping to hear that the reasons had to do with the disruption of the pandemic, in the sense of this was just a matter of not having as many in-person interactions, as many opportunities for those nudges by trusted adults to help students and families through a complicated financial aid process, because that would be easy to reinstate once everything's back to in-person learning. And that was one set of reasons given, that in the disruption of the pandemic. There were so many things to keep track of that FAFSA was not always the priority anymore, and that those who were trying to talk about it needed to find ways to connect with parents and families that were different from what they would usually be able to have at their fingertips. The other set of reasons, though, had more to do with decreased interest in students in going to college in the first place. So the first category, whether or not a student wants to go to college, the question is, can we help them learn about FAFSA? The second category is, a student might know about FAFSA and choose not to fill it out because, for example, they took a full-time job during, or full-time or part-time job during pandemic because they're remote learning. That gave them that flexibility. And now it's more difficult to turn down those earnings to defer them until after college and potentially take on debt in the process as well. Or for a family that had been hard hit by the economic recession alongside the pandemic, the additional cost of college was a barrier. Or even something like being sick of online learning during high school and not being sure what college experience would look like in a pandemic. So kind of a wide range of potential reasons, depending on the student, depending on the type of school or district, but generally either a case of not having all of the supports in place that one might usually have to be able to promote FAFSA, and or a student's own interests decreasing.
Right. So a lot of schools were virtual or hybrid, so students didn't have the sort of hands-on access to help with filling out these forms. And then because of either economic circumstances or thinking it wouldn't be worth it to go to college if their classes were going to be virtual, students lost some of the motivation that they might have had to pursue higher education.
Yeah, I'd say that that's right. And on the first piece particularly, also a number of school and district leaders talked about how much trust there needs to be between students and families and school officials when it comes to the FAFSA. You're talking about sensitive financial information. You're talking about students' personal plans for the future. And that trust is harder to build, and those relationships are harder to build when it's either a remote environment and or an environment that's just so overall disrupted.
So you talked about how the progress that students of color made in filling out the FAFSA, how that progress was completely wiped out in the past 2 years. Can you talk about some of the numbers of how students who historically have had the most barriers to attending college were the ones who were affected the most in these FAFSA numbers? What did you find there?
Yeah, so we looked, the different cuts we did were, number one, looking at students who attended schools predominantly serving majority students of color. Number two, schools that served a student population of greater than 10% English learner enrollment. And then number three, schools that served students that came majority from low-income households. And across all three of those measures, those schools saw greater FAFSA completion rate dips than their peer schools. And that's perverse, seems to be the word that comes to mind, because these are the students for whom the FAFSA really could make the most difference in terms of access to financial aid and access to college. All student groups saw these dips happen, but they disproportionately hit those who could have benefited from it most.
What are some steps that Wisconsin could make to boost FAFSA completion? And did you hear from school districts that they're hopeful that things will bounce back this school year?
It depended on what the district officials or school officials saw as the reason for the decline in the first place. So for those for whom remote learning was a real barrier, there is hope that as students come back to school, those relationships will come back, those in-person opportunities to nudge come back. So return to learning in person, I think there is reason to believe that that will help us with some bounce back. However, that doesn't account for the slide that started even before COVID hit. So A number of possible interventions range the spectrum from things that any individual school could do to something that it would take state action on. This is anything from funding streams that are dedicated toward focus on this work, whether that's campaigns to increase awareness in a school community. This could be incentives, meal-based events, student gift cards were a popular one amongst schools that had seen good success in increasing their completion rates. Could also be something like a text nudge program, which could be administered at school level, district level, even state level. There are a couple of states that will send automated reminders via text around important deadlines, just to keep it front of mind, and particularly for students and families who are using their devices more. That can be a helpful thing. The last potential intervention I'll touch on would be more of a statewide one and is probably the most heavy-handed of the ones that we considered, which is related to connecting FAFSA completion to graduation requirements for high schoolers. There are 6 states that have implemented this. It's shown promising results, but there are important considerations around making sure that the requirement comes with opt-out clauses, comes with attached supports and funding, and accounts for undocumented students who are not eligible for the FAFSA.
So the window to complete this year's FAFSA for high schoolers who are graduating in 2022 opened on October 1st. What do you think high school counselors are telling students about the FAFSA?
Oh, I think you would need to ask the high school counselors, but I think there is a push underway from the state level to increase awareness of FAFSA. October is FAFSA filing month or FAFSA filing awareness month. And so I would hope that that is at the front of high school counselors' awareness, and that the primary message to students is that this is not about deciding one way or another what your post-secondary plans are, but making sure that you know what your options are. And unless a student and a family can see, here's what college may or may not cost us, which is often very different from the sticker price, it's hard to make that calculation. So this is just about making sure that parents and students are equipped with the information they need to be able to make an informed decision.
Sarah Shaw is the senior education researcher at the Wisconsin Policy Forum. She spoke with WUWM education reporter Emily Files about the decline in FAFSA completion during the pandemic, a bad sign for college enrollment. Coming up, he has his own statue to memorialize the fame and glory he brought to Milwaukee. And no, we're not talking about the Bronze Fonz. We're talking about the Crusher. We'll have more on the pro wrestler's career in 10 minutes. But first, we'll look at some of the many events happening this month in Milwaukee. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. October is in full swing here in Milwaukee. Neighborhoods around the city are already sporting Halloween decorations, and the calendar is full of events celebrating the season and our community. Every month, Adam Carr from the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service joins me to talk about some of these events happening in the city. Adam, thank you as always for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thanks for having me, Joy.
So there's a lot of great stuff happening this month in Milwaukee, including a number of businesses that are opening, and this is among them.
Absolutely. I'm really excited. Taste of Lindsay Heights, a brand new business which just recently opened up in the Walnut Way neighborhood at 1617 North Avenue. It's a storefront that I remember, and many of your listeners might remember, as the Juice Kitchen, which used to be there. Taste of Lindsay Heights is a carryout cafe featuring cuisine from people living in the neighborhood and local food entrepreneurs. So it's owned and operated by the great nonprofit Walnut Way. And it really is a resident-driven project from beginning to end. I looked at their menu, and it seems like it'll change depending on, you know, food entrepreneurs that are coming through. But they have smoothies, smoothie bowls, they have baked potatoes, they have oatmeal, they have salads, pizzas, all kinds of different things. They have funky fresh spring rolls. So their focus is on healthy food, but then also supporting local food entrepreneurs that are really getting off the ground. So some of these food entrepreneurs might grow and be in their own individual storefront at some point, or in a food truck or something like that. So I'm excited. It's an interesting concept. It's a community-based concept, and it sounds delicious.
All right, so on to our next thing happening this month. This is something over in a neighborhood that I always find endlessly fascinating, Bronzeville.
Absolutely. Sometimes I say that if Milwaukee's story were a bookshelf, a lot of the books would be missing because important stories haven't been written down or haven't been collected. There's a new book that just came out from Dr. Sandra Jones named Voices of Milwaukee, Bronzeville. And I love the way that she describes the book, that I actually spent a lot of time trying to remember what Milwaukee's Bronzeville was like. So I try to transport myself through my imagination onto Walnut Street in the 50s and the 60s before urban renewal and the highway. And she points out there are people that can just remember this. Some of our elders that are still in the community. She went and collected stories from some of the families who came to Milwaukee through the second wave of the Great Migration, who were able to start rooting themselves in what we call the Bronzeville neighborhood today. And she's written those stories down. She's collected them. You know, it's sort of a whole spirit. There is such a thriving small business community and just community in general. So these interviews, I think, are just a critical archive of a period of Milwaukee that is, I think we're giving it its due more these days, but for a long time really was kind of forgotten, and in part because physically where Bronzeville used to reside was destroyed. So Historic Milwaukee, Inc. is hosting on October 7th a book talk with Dr. Sandra Jones, and she'll talk about Voices of Milwaukee, Bronzeville, and I'm just so excited. I'm personally excited to go to it because, you know, sometimes the story, the behind-the-scenes story, the process of collecting these stories is just as interesting as what she'll collect in the book itself.
It promises to be a really interesting conversation about the history of Milwaukee, of course. The next event is also a kind of a conversation, but with a decidedly different topic.
Absolutely. So, you know, we're connected to this one. In this summer, myself, Adam, I help run our op-ed column called Community Voices. And we noticed a lot of people were reflecting on the pandemic, which we kind of thought we were through. And there were all these lessons that they learned. And also those lessons and sort of the dysfunction sometimes they saw surface during the pandemic led them to visions of a better city, of a better community, of how changes they wanted to see in their field. So we asked a bunch of Milwaukeeans to write their thoughts down, and we got great pieces on food, education, arts and culture, small business, faith, and more. And the authors of these are all great community members in Milwaukee. And after they wrote these reflections, we thought, you know, why don't we put those people in conversations with each other? So at Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service, we have partnered with the Zeither Group to do Frank Talks in both October and November. And what that means is you'd come, you'd see a panel of the authors discussing their lessons they've learned through the pandemic, through their personal experiences and their perspectives. Then facilitators would lead the group through small group conversations. So if you attend, you're not just in the audience, you'll also have a chance to participate in dialogue. Those are on the evenings of October 13th and November 10th, two different Frank Talks with five of the six authors of these op-eds written in our A New Way Forward series. That's what we called it. And I'm really excited for these conversations because, you know, as challenging as the pandemic has been, I think it's also been a time of great revealing.
For sure. So looking at another place in town that will be opening, we have something that's coming up over on Cesar Chavez.
Absolutely. So La Placita is the newest in a small public space in the city of Milwaukee. On Thursday, October 14th, from 4:30 to 6 p.m., La Placita is officially opening on Cesar Chavez Drive, right in front of the El Rey. And what La Placita is there's been a statue there for a few years of Cesar Chavez. And it's about life size, actually. So he's kind of striding. And they built around him a representation of the United Farm Workers flag there, as well as some seating areas as well. There's also been some ceramic tiles that have been installed around the area that have messages of love, courage, and hope. And this urban plaza, really the idea of it is a lot in a lot of the Spanish-speaking world, there's these gathering points for people. And right on Cesar Chavez Drive, near the Si Se Puede mural and the new Dolores Huerta mural that's just a couple blocks away, there's now this little gathering area. And I'll say this, I was there with some of my neighborhood news service colleagues recently, some of the reporters and I gathered there, and we had some great conversations just with community members who were hanging out there. So yeah, La Placita is a new, small, beautiful, and intimate public space right in front of the El Rey on Cesar Chavez Drive, and its official opening is on Thursday, October 14th.
Well, and not too far away, we're looking at our next event, which is going to be a celebration of Dia de los Muertos over at Forest Home Cemetery.
Absolutely. I think the end of October, there's actually no shortage of options to celebrate and to participate in Dia de los Muertos. I think celebrate might actually be the wrong word, because it is a contemplative day where people remember lost loved ones. I love the recognition of not just of saying death is a bad thing, but embracing the memories of those we've lost. So every year, Walker's Point Center for the Arts, in the 29th year of doing a gallery opening of ofrendas or shrines to loved ones. UCC, the United Community Center, is doing some great events and their gallery. They're also welcoming on October 29th the band Las Cafeteras, who's going to be playing a Day of the Dead concert. But this year in the Forest Home Cemetery, which is a monument to lost people, to people who have passed in Milwaukee, on October 30th, they're doing an all-day festival as well as a 5K run and walk. Personally, I actually love going to Forest Home any time of the year, but on this day, it'll be an appropriate day to go there. There's a 5K run walk through the cemetery in the morning, and then after that all day there's going to be food trucks, vendors, arts and crafts, music and entertainment, traditional Day of the Dead ofrendas created by Luna, face painting, all kinds of different things happening there at Forest Home Cemetery on October 30th. Day of the Dead, obviously, because of the Disney movie and for other reasons, has become a little bit more mainstreamed, and we have some beautiful deep-rooted community celebrations that happen here on the south side of Milwaukee.
All right. Well, a lot of great ways to celebrate the holiday and a lot of great ways to get out into the community this October. As always, Adam Carr, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Troy, and I'll see you next month.
Adam Carr is the deputy editor for community engagement at the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service. Ahead of this weekend's Crusher Fest, we'll look back at the career of South Milwaukee's De Crusher and the early days of pro wrestling. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWN, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWN. I'm Joy Powers. You may know the beer that made Milwaukee famous, but how about the man? Reggie De Crusher Lazowski was a pro wrestler from South Milwaukee, whose career spanned from the 1950s through the 80s. His tagline, "The Man Who Made Milwaukee Famous," was a nod to his character, which was pure Milwaukee. De Crusher was a blue-collar, beer-drinking man who ate Polish sausages and came on stage to polka music. This persona is part of what endeared him to Chris Smith, a South Milwaukee native, and the organizer that helped build a statue in honor of De Crusher. Smith and I spoke about Crusher's career and the early days of pro wrestling in 2019, while the statue was being constructed.
The thing about De Crusher was he reached his height of popularity and peaked just like all people do, wrestlers, celebrities, whatever. And he was winding down at the end of his career just as wrestling kind of got into the mainstream in the 80s with Hulk Hogan and Andre the Giant and all those guys. And Crusher, you know, wrestled a little bit for the WWF right at the end of his career, part-time. But if the nationalization of wrestling would have occurred earlier, or if the Crusher somehow could have prolonged his career, you know, he was like Hulk Hogan, before Hulk Hogan. Hulk Hogan actually learned from him. They came up in the same company, which was called the AWA, and it was based out of Minneapolis. And so they wrestled all over the place. Crusher wrestled all over the planet, but primarily it was a Midwest territory. And so that's why he's still very popular among the baby boomer generation, especially Milwaukee, because no matter where he wrestled, he was announced, you know, the man that made Milwaukee famous. And so he reached a pretty significant, at least in the Midwest and especially in Wisconsin, I mean, you could definitely consider him a celebrity at the time.
So he was the PBR of wrestlers.
Absolutely. I mean, he's very, just very Milwaukee.
As someone who is not so familiar with, you know, the history of WWE, the history of wrestling, professional wrestling more generally mm-hmm. in the U.S., what was it like in the 1960s, 1970s, compared to what we might think of more in the 80s and even now?
It's an interesting history. I mean, you go back to the 50s and wrestling was covered like any sport is now. In the newspapers, and people followed it like it was a legitimate sporting competition. Now we know, and most suspected, or maybe in the 50s, not most, but some suspected, that it was scripted, okay? And it still is. But, you know, wrestlers to this day do not appreciate anyone, you know, claiming that it's fake because the pain is real, and these are, and Crusher was a terrific athlete. His tag team partner, Dick the Bruiser, played for the Packers. So, I mean, they're real athletes. It's absolutely real. But, you know, the endings are and probably always were scripted. So back in the 50s and 60s and 70s, this was what they call the territorial days. And you had Vince McMahon Sr. in the Northeast, based in New York City. And you had someone called Vern Gagne, who was based out of Minneapolis, and he ran the AWA. And then you had the Mid-South, and you had the Houston wrestling. You had a bunch of territories, and they were very territorial, and they respected each other's territories. And the AWA, which covered the Midwest, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Illinois, was very successful. A lot of the wrestlers that the younger generations have heard about, it wouldn't be unusual for them to come through the AWA, like Hulk Hogan, Big John Studd, Bobby the Brain Heenan, Mean Gene Okerlund. They all came through the AWA. And so what ended up happening in the 80s, Vince McMahon Sr., who ran what was first called the WWWF, but then they shortened it to just the WWF, he sold the company to his son, Vince McMahon Jr., and Vince McMahon Jr. did something that no one ever did and that really the other promoters didn't like. He basically bought airtime in every territory. Just long story short, nationalized wrestling. And it was a success. The other territories fought him, but he was making enough money that he could lure the big stars like Hulk Hogan from the AWA. And then it just, in the late 80s, mid to late 80s, it got extremely popular. They teamed up with MTV, did something called Rockin' Wrestling. And at the time, very popular celebrities got involved, like Mr. T and Cyndi Lauper. And so it just kind of took off and the territories kind of died. And so Crusher was absolutely one of the most popular wrestlers in the territories. And unfortunately, when Vince McMahon Jr. kind of took over, he did bring Crusher on, but it was a very part-time basis because he was just older and he just was at the end of his career at that point. So
you mentioned, you know, in the 1950s, it was regarded as this kind of, you know, very real sport. Mm-hmm. But there is that scripted element of it now and in the 60s and 70s. Mm-hmm. And it seems like the personas are a big part of that and a big part of what really made the Crusher mm-hmm. who he was. Can you give us some, you know, he was the Milwaukee guy. Can you give us some examples of how that manifested in his character?
Absolutely. I mean, your character, you know, and wrestlers now call it your gimmick. Okay, you have to have something that gets the crowd interested in you. You know, wrestler's worst nightmare is you're out there, you're getting announced, and the crowd does nothing. They want you either booing or they want you cheering, okay? Either one is good. You know, so over the decades, wrestlers come up with a character. Andre the Giant was the big, mean, nasty giant. You know, before that, he was a good guy too. But, you know, you had cowboys. You had a guy from Canada who called himself Rowdy Roddy Piper, who wore a kilt and acted like he was from Scotland. And you had people in masks. And you had people who were like, you know, voodoo priests. You had Native American characters, you know. So Crusher's character, if you will, I don't know how much different it was from who he was as a person, because it was he would come out to polka music. He would call himself the man that made Milwaukee famous. He would do interviews and talk about, you know, back in Milwaukee, he won the crown of Mr. Saloon 10 years in a row, and that's because he could eat the most Polish sausage and drink the most beer and throw the drunks out of the saloon and do the polka. And very famously, he would say his workout consisted of running along the shores of Lake Michigan with a keg of beer on his shoulder. And when his workout was over, the keg was empty. You know, so that was his character, and it was probably very much inspired by who he really was, because he grew up in South Milwaukee, went to South Milwaukee High School. He raised a family there. And I work in that town. I work for the city. And if I had a dollar for every Crusher story I've heard from people there, I'd have a lot more money than I do now.
You know, you mentioned the beer barrel, running mm-hmm. around with a beer barrel. And he himself was a very barrel-chested yeah. kind of guy, not exactly who you would look at and say, oh, that man's a wrestler.
Yeah, he didn't have the physique of like a bodybuilder like some wrestlers do, especially in the 80s, a lot of them did. But he was built, and he was thick, and he was strong. And in this process here of creating this statue, I've worked closely with the Crusher's daughters, which has been very much a joy for me. And Crusher measured all his measurements, his biceps, his chest, and they kept that. And so the statue is actually going to mirror that. And he was a big, stout guy. Now, his physique changed as he got older a little bit, but he was always a big, strong man.
For someone who was able to have a very long career, considering what his career was, you have to imagine he was very fit.
Right. And before he could wrestle full time and before he started wrestling, he, you know, was a blue collar worker. He was a bricklayer. He had a bunch of jobs that were all very physical. And then he became successful enough wrestling that he could do that full time.
So you mentioned you've been working with his daughters mm-hmm. to get this statue built. You know, what is that process like actually getting the place to put the statue, I'm assuming there's permits involved with that. Mm-hmm. And then getting really the momentum in the community to get this thing built and building it.
Well, you know, going back to raising the money, I mean, I talked to a number of different places that could create the statue, and pretty much my target was $40,000. And honestly, I anticipated this being something that would kind of just mirror my career. I'm 40. I just turned 40. And I thought over the next 20, 25 years, you know, I'll try to do this. And then hopefully by the time I retire, I'll have enough money that I can kick in whatever we need and then get this thing done. And, you know, it just goes to show that still, you know, I mean, we're 14 years after his death. He died in 2005. How much people still love him. I launched the website in very late December, after Christmas 2017, and we were fully funded by March. So 3 months, basically. And we actually got more donations than we even thought we needed. And so then the process of actually creating the statue, we picked a very reputable firm in Milwaukee called Vanguard Sculpture Services. The owner actually went to South Milwaukee High School, knew the Crusher's daughters, so it was kind of very cool. And I've had a lot of people in the city come up to me and say, oh, you're so popular for doing this. Because it's in 2019, 2018, pretty much it doesn't seem like people can agree on anything. But social media, you got to really search for a negative comment about the Crusher statue, okay? We're not asking for public money. It was all privately funded. And pretty much the response has been super positive. And so I've had people come up to me and say, whoa, you're very popular in South Milwaukee right now because you're behind this. And I would always reply to them, yeah, but if the statue turns out and looks like crap, my name will be mud. But very recently we have seen, and the Crusher's daughters and myself have seen, the final clay sculpture, and we gave it the green light to go forward to make the mold, to get, you know, whatever this process is, to have it made out of bronze. And I am no longer worried about my name being mud over this, at least, because it looks wonderful.
Chris Smith organized and fundraised for De Crusher statue. We spoke in 2019. Lazowski is going to be inducted into the Minnesota Wrestling Hall of Fame. That induction will be celebrated at this weekend's Crusher Fest, which will feature live wrestling, special guests, a broad brawl, and much more. For more information about the event, you can go to decrusher.org. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. For the past year, the housing market has been extremely competitive. And tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll look ahead to what the home buying market could look like in 2022. Plus, we'll hear some of the latest Listen MKE, which focuses on electrical fires that are disproportionately impacting Black renters in Milwaukee. That's all tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect. On listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.